hi, welcome back to Climate Queens and our special summer series. So for the next three episodes, we'll be partnering with an amazing NGO called Frontline Defenders. And as you all know, as you're listening at this point, we are pretty passionate about climate change and climate activism. And when we think of climate activism, we don't always think of those who face personal risks working to protect the environment. In some countries, human rights defenders are advocating for action on the climate, and they can be threatened, harassed, and detained for their peaceful work. So we especially wanted to highlight those who are directly impacted by the climate crisis in this way, not think of a better organization to partner with than Frontline Defenders.
Yes, so Frontline Defenders is an Ireland-based international human rights organisation with the specific aim of protecting human rights defenders, or HRDs, at risk. Over the next few months, we'll be speaking to three human rights defenders from different countries, discussing their stories and bringing you their experience on the front lines. Today, we'll be speaking to a fascinating HRD from Brazil. But before we speak to Marcelo, we'd like to introduce you to Tara Madden, who is Head of Operations and Engagement at Frontline Defenders. Hello, Tara. Welcome.
Hello there. Lovely to be here with you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. So firstly, we'd love to start with, what is a human rights defender?
Human rights defenders are people who demonstrate amazing courage to defend the rights of others in spite of the most terrible risks. And they do this every day in their local communities in every country in the world. So human rights defenders can be community leaders, lawyers, journalists, trade unionists, gay rights activists, or environmentalists. So anybody at all who works peacefully to protect the rights of others. So people like Lucha Castro, a lawyer who has received death threats for her work providing legal support to women victims of violence in northern Mexico. People like Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja, who is serving a life sentence in prison in Bahrain for his work as a democracy activist. Or people like Berta Cáceres, an indigenous woman from Honduras who was murdered because of her work defending the rights of the Lenca people. She had led campaigns and protests against mega projects that polluted rivers and violated the rights of local communities. So they are targeted because of their willingness and their bravery to speak out. And at Frontline Defenders, we believe that they are the most effective in the struggle to defend and advance human rights and indeed in climate action and climate justice.
Wow. That's amazing. And then in terms of what you do in Frontline Defenders, in terms of supporting these amazing people, could you talk a little bit to that?
Sure. So Frontline Defenders was set up by an Irish woman almost 20 years ago, Mary Lawler, and she had seen the gap. She recognized the vital role of human rights defenders in advancing human rights all over the world, and that they were facing incredible personal risks due to their human rights activities. So she set up Frontline Defenders to provide rapid and practical support to defenders at immediate risk. And she built up the organization over the past 20 years until her retirement in 2016. And actually, she has gone on now to become what we call the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Defenders. So she represents the United Nations to receive information about human rights defenders, to enter into dialogue with governments and to make recommendations for their protection. So in Frontline Defenders, we are based here in Dublin with our headquarters here. We have 50 staff in total, about 30 based here in headquarters. We have a small office in Brussels, and then regionally based staff in Europe and Central Asia, Middle East and North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, and then also Asia Pacific and the Americas. So we have an emergency hotline in several languages that human rights defenders can ring up any hour of the day, 24/7, if they're at immediate risk. We provide protection grants for security measures, so to strengthen the security of the defender's office or their home, or to keep them safe while they're traveling, or to pay for legal fees or medical treatment, things like that. We provide security advice and training in personal security, organizational security, and then online digital security with social media accounts, with our phones and things like that. We also then put a lot of energy into publicizing the cases of human rights defenders at risk. So on our website, we would have documented new cases of human rights defenders receiving threats because of their work, and we campaign and we advocate at the international level with the EU and with the UN and with governments directly. So we're always trying to raise awareness about the role of human rights defenders. We want to bring visibility and recognition to their work. And really, we believe that they're not environmental rights defenders aren't being politically prioritized, and the link between sustainable development and the role of human rights defenders and the importance of protection of human rights defenders and environmental rights defenders needs to be more prominent in the climate action and climate justice discourse. So we're delighted to have an environmental rights defender joining us today. So Marcelo is based in the Amazon in Brazil. And he actually has an economics background and created a social business focused on ecological waste management. So he co-founded an NGO dedicated to raising environmental awareness. And this led to the Alter de Chão Firefighting Brigade, which I think he's going to tell us more about. Mm-hmm. And he's also an entrepreneur. He has three companies in the ecotourism business. And prior to this environmental activism, he had been a partner in a large international consulting company, and he spent over 12 years working in financial markets. So he has a very interesting story to tell us.
Thank you very much for the invitation and the interest in hearing a little bit of my story and my thoughts regarding the Amazon and where we stand in terms of protecting it.
Tara just gave you quite the introduction there. She kind of finished off by saying that you spent over 12 years working in the financial market, which is so interesting. So maybe if you want to kick off, Marcelo, by, you know, telling us your first encounter really with the environmental movement in Brazil, or was it a gradual transition that you became aware of the environmental rights? And how was it in your journey?
Okay. Well, I think that I've been always a nature lover. I've been always very connected to the natural environment. I mean, I'm a surfer. I've always took little breaks to go into nature spots and living in São Paulo, but spending many weekends off out in the country and on the beach. And so that connection with nature has always been here, but I was very much of a urban guy until I was about 30 years old. But I had this concern over the environment growing, and actually has always been here, but not really, I didn't do anything regarding to that. But then I guess I started to see kind of a problem of being concerned with the environment, but working for companies that having clients that were not particularly concerned as I was. And I could see why I was a financial consultant that this wasn't a concern for a lot of people in that environment. So that kind of started growing in me, and I started to question if that was the right place for me to be working for large companies like that. I remember once I was in New York doing a multimillionaire transaction, and everything was doing good, and I was between thinking about how much money I was gonna earn and all those things that people in the financial markets always think, in having all those concerns over social inequality and the protection of the environment. And I remember that day in New York that I was going for a walk at night after some meetings I had in the skyscrapers of Manhattan. And I stopped by on Fifth Avenue in front of a store, a watch store, I think Tag Heuer store or something, with the watches worth over $20,000 or so. But there was people laying on the ground and sleeping on the floor right in front of that store. And that hit me really hard because I was seeing how much difficulty there were people going through, and while I was negotiating something so large in terms of money, and while there was a store selling a non-essential item for so much, and that kind of money would really be beneficial to people like that, and so that really shocked me in a way that I began to question very much what I was doing for the better of the world, or if I was just doing something for myself. And right about then, I did a vacation trip to the Amazon, to Altar do Chão, and just fell in love for the place. I mean, I literally became in love with the river and the forest, and really started to realize that I didn't need that much to be happy. The things that make me happy are simple things, are not expensive things, just as fresh air and clean water, and how much that is the real important things for me, in that I didn't have to wait all the way to the weekend or vacation to be in contact with nature, that I could make this proximity to nature part of my daily life. So it was kind of a gradual thing before I actually moved to Altar do Chão, to the Amazon. It took about a year and a half. But after that first trip, I already bought a land there and started doing my first business there, which is a type of a experience hostel related to that connects yoga and meditation to the stay of the people that goes there. And after a few months, I was done with the financial markets, and I saw no purpose in continue to be there. So after I moved to Altar do Chão and started to live in the natural area, that it came to me how important it was that I do something for that place that I loved, for the Amazon that I became in love with. And then I started to get involved with a friend. We started a business, a social business of waste management. We provided to little hotels and restaurants the collection of organic waste to compost it and turn into fertilizer, biofertilizers. And that was an attempt to not only tackle a problem of the place, which was the organic waste all around, and also to raise income to local people. So it was a dual goal objective with this venture. After some time with this social business going on, I joined up with friends that were starting also a firefighting brigade. And we realized that we wanted to do this much for the community, for the protection of the environment in the region. And so we decided that we had to take a step further, and we created our NGO to really institutionalize those two initiatives. And then we created the Aquifer Institute, things to help out the people over Altar do Chão and protect the place. So that was, in short, how I became this environmental defender too. And that was until November of last year, where everybody saw the tragedy of the Amazon fires. In our region, it was not different. In September, there was a large fire, and we kind of led all the efforts to combat that fire in September. And that was very much acknowledged by the people, by the media, and how important it was for Alter do Chão to have a volunteer firefighting brigade. And so we started to receive a lot of support from other NGOs, and especially from WWF in Brazil. And we also had donations from regular people in São Paulo. Our network was supporting us for us to equip our firefighting brigade and also create more firefighting brigades over the larger region. So everything was going fine until the police raided our houses and accused us without any proof that we were the ones setting the fires to benefit from donations. So me and my colleagues, we were arrested for 3 days in a very, very, with a large repercussion and in Brazil and abroad.
Wow. Honestly, Marcelo, you have a really incredible story and have done so many amazing things. I just want to kind of reverse slightly there, if you don't mind, just to kind of get a little bit more information from you in relation to generally the burning of the Amazon rainforest, because it's something that reached kind of mass media and mainstream media close to a year ago now, and it completely shook the environmental movement, but it seems to have kind of gone slightly quiet in the news and the headlines now. Do you mind just kind of recapping for our listeners what actually happened this time last year to the Amazon rainforest, and kind of give us an idea of the current situation and what it's like now in Brazil?
Sure, definitely. Deforestation in Brazil was something really high in the 90s, but then in reached a top over 2002. But then the then government really created very important programs to combat deforestation. And so deforestation came to a record low level from in 2010 or 11. It went down more than 80% and then started to pick up somewhat and stabilized around 5,000 square kilometers per year of deforestation from 2012 to 2017. Right. But then in Brazil, a far-right president was elected, and his rhetoric was always that development must had to be emphasized in the Amazon area. He was a supporter of mining and farming in the Amazon region and elsewhere, and how the environmental protection in Brazil actually harmed the economy and that kind of nonsense. And so he was elected saying that actually NGOs were the real problem of Brazil, and in that they didn't allow the entrepreneurs, the agriculture entrepreneurs to thrive, and that kind of rhetoric. By only saying that kind of stuff, the federal government actually incentivized farmers and land grabbers and all kinds of illegal or legal ventures to go for it and deforest. Actually, the government and the president would say the opposite. They would say that they would go after those that protect the Amazon, and that's what they did in our case. So that sparked sharp growth in deforestation while he was in the election, but then very sharp growth in the deforestation rates last year. And mm-hmm. the fires is just a more seeable part of the deforestation. So they first cut down the valuable trees and then they set the fires. So that's why we saw so much last year, because those criminals that set the forest on fire, they felt safeguarded by the federal government. So last year, we had the highest deforestation rate over 12 years. And the fires, they go on from August to December, more or less, because that's the dry season in the Amazon. So you can set fire during the wet season, which is now, and it's going to end that dry season, that wet season ends in July now. So that's why it's been kind of quiet in terms of globally, the global media. But deforestation in Brazil went up in the first few months of this year compared to last year, which was already a 12-year high. So you're going to see this year another record in deforestation. And very likely, many scientists are projecting that this year the fires will be equal or worse than last year, starting probably in July, peaking in August and September. Wow. So the outlooks are green to the rainforest. While we have in power that type of rhetoric and actually real measures that were taken, such as trying to deregulate the environmental protections, curtailing the organisms that try to fight it. They also reduced the civil society on councils, the seats on councils, environmental councils, and so forth. So there's been many measures being taken in Brazil right now. That it's not that they are failing to combat deforestation, but they are actually incentivizing it, being part of the growth of that deforestation.
And Marcelo, what industries are benefiting from the deforestation of the Amazon in Brazil specifically?
It's kind of, there are industries benefiting, mainly soy industry and meat packing industries. Mm-hmm. Those are the two that actually are the lands of the deforested lands are used for. But in fact, only just a small part of the deforested areas are actually used for that. Around 60% of the deforested lands are just abandoned lands because they become real deserts and it's pretty hard to plant or anything in those lands, though. So they end up being abandoned by the ones that acquired those lands from the people that actually committed those crimes of grabbing that land and deforesting that land. So we are actually deforesting the Amazon to do mainly nothing. It's not that there's people that say that, we need to feed the world and Brazil is the world salary and that's why we need to chop down the Amazon so that people have what to eat. But that's a lie. That's not true at all, because the large majority of the deforested land is just abandoned. And that land is deforested mainly to profit from the selling of those lands, the legal selling of those lands. So it's shocking that we saw a few weeks ago several large pension funds threatening to divest from Brazilian companies and government bonds if measures are not taken. But I really think that the period of threats, it's over. I mean, it's time to really do something about it globally, because it's clear that the current government is not going to do anything in their power to prevent that from happening. So I'm sorry I don't bring very good news, but it's actually very sad that we have people that really don't see the value of the forest alive for the planet, for the climate, for the biodiversity. They don't see how the forest is much more valuable while alive, and that Brazil could be a powerhouse in a bioeconomy, or could be a leader into the discussions on climate change and how Brazil could stand up as being a keeper of the planet, so to speak, holding that such large forest. And they still think, as last century thoughts, that we need to cut down the trees, because they don't do nothing for us. They still think like that.
And we really want to hear about your work with, now please correct me if I'm pronouncing this wrong, Alter de Chao, is that right?
Yes, kind of, yes.
So the Alter de Chao Firefighting Brigade. But before we kind of ask you a little bit more about that, we'd love to know, just from your kind of knowledge and experience, what is the importance of the Amazon rainforest, I suppose, to our planet as a whole?
Well, I'm not a scientist to really have a strong background to talk about that scientifically speaking, but there are many studies that shows that the trees in the Amazon, they release a lot of water into the atmosphere, so all of the rains in South America are regulated by the Amazon. They exist because of the Amazon. There's even an expression called the flying rivers, which are the moist generated by the Amazon forest that travels throughout Brazil and mainly to the south of Brazil and prevents Brazil from being a desert. It's supposed to be the air conditioning of the world, because it helps cooling down the planet because of those gas changes with the atmosphere. There's probably some numbers say 50% of all the biodiversity comes from the Amazon worldwide. I mean, there's some numbers I recall that are like 70% of the different species of fish, freshwater fish, are there. Some real important things for just from medicines, from new antibiotics. Now it's being widely announced that the forest is important to maintain those pathogens, those viruses, such as the coronavirus, inside the forest and within the natural occurrences of them. And by deforesting the Amazon, you could unleash several of those pandemic viruses. So there's a large list of benefits that the planet enjoys by having the Amazon.
Obviously, coming up to the dry season, we're in June now. You're saying it's August. So with Alter de Chao, with the Firefighting Brigade, how many people are involved in what you're doing, and can you tell us a bit about maybe how can you be protected so you guys aren't arrested again?
We've been into discussions over what we do with the future of the brigade. Nowadays, we stopped this initiative since we were arrested, and the case is still open, actually. Okay. It hasn't been closed down yet, although everyone that takes a look into the case and knows our work knows that we are innocent. The case isn't closed as of now. And so we decided not to continue while we don't have that clear innocence on us by the justice. And now that the fire season, as we call it, approaches, we are discussing maybe that other people would take that role instead of us personally. Our institution, that it's the owner of the equipment that we acquired, could donate that to another entity, or if it's going to be lent to those people willing to carry out that work. We're still in discussions and how do we continue to do that important work. We've been advised to be on a kind of a request operating system in which the public, the firefighters, the government firefighters or any other public institution calls us for action. I mean, documentedly calls us to help out, not like we used to do, which was seeing fire and communicating and go there to stop it. So we are in the middle of those discussions right now, because I'm not really up there. Out of the four that were arrested, only one is there still. I'm planning to go back, but this was also a kind of a shock prison, a prison to make people afraid. I mean, to really demonstrate that you should not go there and try to do what we were doing, you know. So there's a lot of people that wouldn't want to continue because they now are afraid that something similar to them would happen. And it wasn't worse, maybe. I wouldn't know that for a fact, but it could have been worse if I wasn't a white, privileged guy from São Paulo. If I were to be an indigenous guy or a person from there without this network that we have, maybe something worse could have happened. I think it was a hard hit that we took in that work we were doing.
And Marcelo, do you believe that your experience is kind of one of many that are happening to environmental NGOs and to people like yourselves who are trying to literally fight the good fight across Brazil?
Yes, and that has been true for very long, mainly indigenous people that try to protect their constitutional rightfully owned lands. They've been massacred for very long, but now that became more of a kind of a with safe passage, that those aggressions are now with safe passage, so to say. So it's been all around. I mean, definitely in Brazil, it's the worst place to be an environmentalist. We used to think about that, but we didn't think it was going to happen with us because we were doing everything so correctfully, and we were documenting everything, creating an institution, having lawyers and having everything right. We didn't think we had we offered an angle to be attacked, but we did. And so if that can happen to us, that we're kind of prepared for to be investigated and to demonstrate very, very clearly that we are doing everything right, if there's people less organized, they could do anything. So it really is a dangerous place to defend the environment, because there's so many of those money interests in the area.
For like our listeners, like I'm sure we're based in Ireland, we have people listening all over, and they mightn't be obviously attached with Brazil, but like, is there something that you would recommend that they could take away from like listening to you and your experience, or anything that they could share to kind of help the cause?
I think the most important thing that the Amazon needs, not us in our work, but the general Amazon needs, it's more people to be there physically interested into the protection, not only be concerned overseas. And I mean, there's plenty of, I think the money is not an issue. I think there's many NGOs, many associations and coalitions, and there's a long list of people and institutions wanting to do, to support our initiatives like ours. But mostly what we need is courageous people that abandon their ordinary life and just go there and try to make a difference. That would be the main help that the Amazon forest could get, more people. I even dreamed once to create a project called the Amazon Shield, which would be to bring young Europeans to actually do kind of like a body protection over areas and in mm-hmm. communities and that kind of stuff, because white people and Europeans, even so, they won't be touched as the indigenous are being killed or exterminated, and that wouldn't happen to people from other countries and even mm-hmm. from São Paulo like myself, and the repercussion of doing anything, it's much larger and people care more about people like that. So I would say coming to Brazil and do some work would be the most important thing to happen. But if not, people can continue to be diligent into know and reading more and talk more and maybe boycott products that can harm the forest, and even donate to all those NGOs and coalitions that try to do and support the works of the people that are there.
Mm-hmm. And Marcelo, I'd love to know, you know, I think I can speak for myself and Claudette that this time last year when we were learning all about the, I think was it, I don't know if this is correct, is it 75,000 fires were alight in the Amazon rainforest? I know even just hearing that number is kind of hard to process, but, you know, I know we found it really hard to come to terms with, but, you know, you were actually there on the front lines. I'd love to know, are you hopeful for the future of kind of environmental activism in Brazil and also generally for our world? I know that's a massive question, but I just would love to know if you are, where do you get your hope from, and are you hopeful?
Mm-hmm. I think that nature can be very resilient. I think that if we kind of more and more people realize the importance of nature, and I think more and more people are aware of that importance, we will leave it alone and you will be fine. I mean, it doesn't need us for anything. So my hope is that a larger and larger number of people get that consciousness leap. Mm. And I think in Brazil, I used to say the night is darker just before dawn. I love that phrase. And so I think that the election of people like that in Brazil, it's kind of a last shot of a dying rhetoric or a really going away from people that are just really deeply connected to those to that greed and to to that necessity of showing power and that kind of stuff. It's really agonizing, and so they had a last chance of showing off, and that has been showing a lot of people how terrible that choice was, and it's going to be like the last time we see that kind of thing coming by. So I get my hope from that thought, that future governments will more and more understand the challenge that we have and what we have to do. I think that internationally that kind of awareness is growing very rapidly. I mean, although it's been since 1992, the Rio Climate Conference, that the countries agreed that something had to be done. Over the last few years, we saw really interesting movements from company leaders and investment funds and the World Economic Forum, Prince Charles there in the United mm-hmm. Kingdom. A lot of people really understanding that if we don't do something about the planet and actually do something about not doing business as usual and transforming our way to act on society, and that would be to drive away from profit only focus and goals mm-hmm. and follow much more relevant goals for our well-being and planet well-being, which is pretty much one connected to the other. So I think it might be too late, but I prefer to think that it's better late than never. So I hope that the changes that we are doing will result in a better future for the next generations. So I think change is coming, and and even though we need a 16-year-old girl to point the finger in their faces for them to change, I think it's people are becoming to realize that that change is inevitable.
Yeah, I think especially now, right, if we think we're in June, we're in a COVID crisis, people are going online now, and all like the Fridays for Future, there's virtual events happening online. I'm just thinking, like you were mentioning there about physically being present to protect the Amazon, you know, is there a way we could do that virtually? How do we make that happen?
I think we can. Generally, in all of our actions, being what we purchase and what we talk about, and the example of you guys, like taking the time to discuss this type of issues, I think everything helps. And I think I'm an economist. Before, as you mentioned, I spent 12 years in the financial markets, and I studied very much corporations and politics and macroeconomics and the history of capitalism. And all of this is something I like very much. And I can see systemic changes going on in actually the people, just like myself, and an example that I waived from being, I didn't see the needs, and it didn't add up to be constantly inside an office and to accumulate more money into what, buy a new car. And I became aware that that was not my mission here. I think that it is happening for more and more people. And that will be a way of really be more conscious of what we need actually to thrive in the world, which is not more shoes and more dresses or more material things. And I think whenever there's a enough amount of people thinking like that and change into how the system actually works, then we will be able to really do a further step into civilization, like we did when we ended slavery, or like we did when we granted access, voting access to women and so forth. That would be the same with social inclusion and environmental protection worldwide. I mean, it's going to be kind of, in my view, like forbidden or even totally immoral to produce something that does harm to the environment. And I think that the current crisis that we live and the whole strategy that is going on, and it's affecting Brazil and United States, it's not coincidence that those two countries are the worst affected. When a tragedy like that happens, I think that's the time that human beings actually try to do something differently. That's how it was to after the world wars, and how people in the governments and corporations and all the multilateralism started in the world, and how many important agreements were made. I think that this current crisis also, in a tragic way, helps us to go to the right direction.
Yeah, and I think just on what you're saying there, Marcelo, I think if anything, this pandemic has really shone a light on the importance of leadership. And like you said, it's no coincidence that Brazil and the US are really struggling at the moment. And I think just on what you're saying there, you know, I think something that's so important is for us to start the conversations, use our voice, and also use our privilege to vote. you know, I think that's so important because that's where we have the power. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
I do. I think voting is definitely the most clear aspect of democracy. But as you mentioned, our voices and in how we, I mean, people have the power. They don't realize that very often. Whenever that's the beauty of that movement, Fridays for Future, is that, well, I'm not going to school unless I see a point in going to school, and that is for you to take care of the future of the planet, because I'll be alive, you're not going to. That's why he got so strong, because he has a real act to it. And so that would be the same for, buying products from where social protections are not in place, and not buying products from places that are being deforested, or even go to the streets and do what you can do to give voice to what you don't agree with. I mean. And actually go, I don't know if it's the same in Europe, but in Brazil for a long time, nobody was interested in going to politics. Everybody was interested in making their own money and living there. That's changing a little bit, but I definitely think that like those leaders in those protests against racism in the United States, they should try to be in office too. I mean, they should try to get involved into politics and be congressmen and women, and actually take part into what they believe are the injustices and how they can change it.
Yeah, nothing was ever changed by being quiet. You have to get loud.
yeah, and take the power. I mean, yeah. if you don't agree with what people are doing there, go there and try to do it yourself.
Okay, well, Marcel, we have one more question. So we've been asking the same question to everyone this season. So we'd like to know, what three things would you like to see happen in the next 10 years to create real change in order to benefit our environment? So this can be on a global scale or more local to where you are.
Well, I think the most important thing, kind of, I mentioned that, it's that I would want to see that it becomes outdated and unethical or even shameful to consume things that you don't need. I would want that to be the main change. I mean, either if like professional soccer players are ashamed of buying sports car, for instance, and if they want to drive a sports car, maybe they can rent it and go for a drive. But all this accumulation status that our society has, I would want to see that change dramatically. I mean, and again, the health crisis of nowadays may help in that sense, is that I would want to see that people are more recognized by what they do to others than what they buy to themselves. And you be more of a respectable person for what you do for the environment or people, rather than how much you accumulated and how important you are in business and so forth. That would be, I think, the most important thing I would like to see for the beneficial change to the environment. I would say a second one, it's more and more women in traditional people, saying indigenous people and people with traditional wisdom, get into leading roles, being on the private sector or the public sector. Mm-hmm. Because I think white, gray hair, male dominance took us to a bad place. And so I think women leadership and in indigenous and simple, more simple people leadership, it's much more important now.
Representation, absolutely.
Yeah, I think those two are big changes that I would be very satisfied if I saw happening in the next 10 years or so.
Absolutely.
And save the Amazon, you know.
Just tag that on.
And saving the Amazon while we do that.
Well, thank you so much, Marcelo. Is there anything you think we have missed or you want to highlight?
Well, no, I think we covered a lot, and we could be talking a lot more of those changes with digital transformation and how I envision and really an utopia for our human family. And I think recalling a great guy that I love to read and watch, which was Buchmeister Fuller, famous architect from the 60s. And he says, he has a book that says it's a utopia or oblivion. And I think we're more than ever coming to that point where we need to either choose that we take the next step into human history and create an utopia for us, or we'll be doomed to be obliterated by history.
Yeah, well, I for one hope that we reach utopian dream where we're just chilling in Alto de Chao with you, Marcelo. And
all right, you're invited right now.
But genuinely, thank you so much for your time. You're extremely articulate and you've got an amazing story to tell. So it's been an honor to speak with you. And we look forward to keeping in touch and hearing about the rest of your work. And thank you.
Thank you for
all the work that you've done.
Thank you, Katie and Clara, for your work too. It's very important for people to get access to those valuable information. And I thank you very much for the invitation. And please give people my Instagram or for people that might want to contact me or further discuss or any ideas to share. I'd be delighted to hear from them.
Well, if you'd like to share that, what is your Instagram handle?
What is your handle?
My Instagram, it's my personal one. It's marcelo.sverner, my name, basically.
Okay, we will post that.
Yeah,
my spelling is very bad. But thank you so much. And also for you guys listening, if you want to hear more voices and perspectives of human rights defenders from around the world, you can also tune into the Frontline Defenders podcast, and that is called Rights on the Line. And you can find more information on most platforms like Spotify and Stitcher, or you can follow them on Instagram at Frontline Defenders and Facebook and Frontline HRD on Twitter. But we're going to post all of this as well with Marcelo and his Instagram information. So we really hope you enjoyed listening and see you soon.
Thank you.